You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where we are always 0% absent of bias. I'm your host, Justin M. Wisniewski, and if you're new around here, if you're joining us for the first time, I'm sorry. But also, we really value honesty here. Just say what you think, say what you mean. We're not going to get mad at you if you're saying what you mean. Now, if you say something or believe something that we really disagree with, we'll explain why, but we're not going to attack you. We're not going to jump down your throats unless you are very, very evil, like the governor of California, Gavin Newsom. But let's get on with the show this week. We've got different people doing different absurd things. We actually have news this week. So let's bring in our news host joining us this trip from our nation's capital, Daniel T. Richards.
Recording this on Mother's Day. I know it'll be released the day after Mother's Day, which is also Mother's Day, since I think every day is Mother's Day, apparently, at least in the new modern America. But recording on Mother's Day, and just had a nice lunch with my wife, mother of my child. I made pancakes this morning, despite the fact that I don't really eat pancakes. And yeah, we've had a pleasant, wonderful day celebrating the mother of Isaac, Faiza.
I love how to honor her on Mother's Day. You made the easiest thing to make, pancakes. Why don't you pour her cereal?
Take pure requests, and if she had said, peel me a banana, I would have done that and said, here you go. Pancakes are a special occasion in our household, Justin. You have to understand that I don't eat breakfast anymore at all. And my wife typically will eat an Eggo. She only eats Eggo brand frozen waffles. And my son will eat eggs and hash or something like that. And we never have pancakes ever. Ever. So I had to sort of figure out how to make them.
Do you ever go to Friendly's simple. And have a funny face pancake?
Hey, what makes a pancake? Do you put a funny face in it?
On it. So they put whipped cream and chocolate chips to make it look like there's a face on it. It's a funny face pancake. It's a Massachusetts thing.
Feels like that's going to run into like a pancake face or something. Like that's going to trigger the woke here any minute now.
We have bigger things to worry about. Hmm. All right, let's bring in our other co-host here. From Dale's Lawn, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Yeah, I'm really excited about the show this week. We get to talk about one of my favorite shows on television right now and dig into some the dying genre that is sci-fi. Can't wait to get through the news.
Yeah, William's like, no news. We don't care about the news. But it's interesting to use the phrase on television because the show's not on television anymore, right?
That's right. It's on Amazon. So a dead show resurrected on Amazon.
Well, let's get into it then. Let's get through the news so we can make William happy. So hit the music for the news with Daniel T. Richards.
Well, I assure you, Mr. Listener, it really is that bad.
Before we hit the news, we want to remind you about Patreon, patreon.com/themidside. Go there, give us a couple bucks every time we produce one of these things and help us keep the lights on, which is something some U.S. field hospitals couldn't do. So they are now shutting down, most of them without seeing a single patient. So, this is from NPR. As hospitals were overrun by coronavirus patients in other parts of the world, the Army Corps of Engineers mobilized in the U.S., hiring private contractors to build emergency field hospitals around the country. The endeavor cost more than $660 million, which is apparently nothing. It's a rounding error now. according to the New World Math. According to an NPR analysis of federal spending records, but nearly 4 months into the pandemic, most of these facilities haven't treated a single patient. Not one patient. So in total, I think we counted yesterday, there have been about just a little under 1,200 patients total for these field hospitals. But 1,100 of those came from the Javits Center in New York City. So about 100 patients spread out all over the rest of the country, including Chicago, Denver, the Washington, D.C. field hospital, which is not yet completed, by the way. Memphis, Tennessee, also not yet completed. Wisconsin, East Orange, New Jersey, not complete. Detroit, which had 39. That was the next highest. So if you take that 660 million and the about 1,200 patients, that's a little over, maybe a lot over $500,000 per patient. Justin, it sounds to me like we've, dare I say, flattened the curve.
I mean, it sounds to me like we overprojected the curve to begin with, which is what I was saying from the beginning. I mean, the thing I don't understand about all of this is looking forward. If we have all of this equipment and all of these locations that we didn't use and didn't need because of our, I'll attribute the flattening the curve, to be generous, to the social distancing and the quarantining and the lockdown and all of that. If we achieved all of that through all of these measures, and we didn't even use all of it, wasn't the other purpose of doing all this to give us time to prepare for any sort of second wave or anything? So why then are we all freaking out about a possible second wave now? Why has that been the twist now? Why have they turned to that now? Oh, well, we're going to let everyone out again, and then there's going to be a second wave that we're not going to be prepared for. Well, if a bunch of people have had it already, because the antibody tests are showing that, which means we're moving towards herd immunity, and now we're more prepared this time than we were the first time, shouldn't we be less worried about the second wave? Shouldn't it be easier? Shouldn't we be able to have less of a lockdown? Fewer people quarantining now?
No, Justin, because you want old people to die.
Oh, that happened to me on Twitter, right? Somebody was complaining about people who walk around with their mask below their nose. And, you know, whatever. I say, if you're going to do that, just don't wear a mask. I don't care. So I just replied. I said, I don't wear a mask. And the person replied and said, I, too, prefer to be dead. And then I replied and I just said the logical argument, which is the odds of getting this are really low. The odds of being hospitalized once you get it are low. And the odds of dying once you're hospitalized are low. So the statistical odds of actually dying from this are incredibly, infinitely low, especially when you look at my age and everything. And then the person just replied, I have asthma. I have severe asthma, but go off. And it's like, that's the trump card through all of this, isn't it, Daniel? That's the reductio ad absurdum of this argument. It's all just, if you don't do this, you don't care about other people. That's literally what this has become. So we've essentially spent... You said, what was it, 500,000 per
Yeah, it's well, it's person? Over, but it's for an easy number, is 500,000 per patient treated at one of these facilities.
It's really 500,000 per virtue signal is what it is.
Oh, man.
That's how much virtue signal. We now have a monetary amount,
going
a
rate.
Monetary value for virtue signal. The going rate for virtue signal is $500,000. In that case, I get why everyone's virtue signaling now. All virtue signal now. America is a racist country.
Where's my $500,000?
Where's my $500,000?
I identify as a they. Where's my $500,000? Yeah, it's all craziness in terms of the amount of money spent. And I wasn't joking when I was saying the $660 million is basically a rounding error in the amount of money that's been spent on COVID so far, but it's still an incredible amount of money in absolute terms. William, when we're looking at this data, and we're looking at other data, not just this data, but 1,100 of these patients treated in New York City, and then if you look at, like, I'm not exactly sure about these numbers, but a rough estimate is about a third of all coronavirus cases are in New York, or deaths are in New York City, a third are in the tri-state area, so just outside of New York City, and a third are the rest of the country. To me, this seems like something really bad happened in New York City. Am I missing something?
No, I think there's something to be said there. Like, do we have it? We may find out later that, you know, putting my engineer hat on, what's different about New York City than other places? Well, it's certainly the population density, right? Same thing with Detroit, right? The population density is the difference there. There's probably something there, right? And so do we need to apply the same restrictions and the same responses to, let's say, New York City as we do rural Michigan, which, you know, my parents continue to tell me hilarious stories of the governor out there. Probably not, right? And then, you know, there's been tons of protests, and we're seeing protests outside of the United States, too, that aren't really being covered. There was a protest in Germany about the restrictions this weekend. And, you know, people are realizing that this is that there's an aspect of overreaction or overcorrection that at once is feeding the virus conspiracy nuts, right? But it's also turning regular people and saying, like, wait, why are we doing these irrational things, right? This doesn't make any sense for my life or my context. And we want to encourage people to hold on to that. Give them the tools they need and let people decide for themselves what safety measures they need to take.
And as Justin has been saying, perhaps something is needed for New York. You know, restrictions of travel to and from New York, quarantining of folks in that area, things like that. But imagine if the tables were turned here and two-thirds of all coronavirus deaths in the country were, let's call it 100 miles from Topeka, Kansas. Do you think New York would give a shit?
I'm going to go stronger than that. What if they were in Florida? What would the national rhetoric be if the two-thirds of the deaths were in Florida? Can you imagine that?
Headlines. Florida gets what it deserves.
Florida man.
Yeah.
Finally.
Florida man's unhealthy habits finally kill him. I mean, the reason I'm saying that is it would literally be New York and California snubbing their noses at Florida. And I agree with you. If it was in Kansas, they would just ignore it. Right? I mean, that's why Superman in the story coming from Kansas is actually such a crazy choice by the creators.
We already have an example, a concrete example of New York and LA ignoring a problem. The whole opioid epidemic, right? Like that is like a huge killer out in red state America, right?
That's because they're all on cocaine, so they're like, what are you guys talking about? Drug addiction's normal.
Yeah.
Can't you just afford good Coke?
Yeah, exactly. But William, I think your point about what's different about New York is well taken, and I just want to add a couple of things to that. Is it's not just the population density. They also have that subway system where it's shown that when you have people inside and there's filtered air and everyone's breathing the same air, that makes it spread more. We're also seeing links with the weather here, where the Northeast is hit really hard because it's colder up there, right? You would think Southern California would get hit really hard, but we're seeing the weather affects that. And then the other thing is, this is something I said early on, if you look at the places that got hit early on, it's the huge amount of diversity that comes with having a lot of people there. So these are international cities, right? New York City is the most international city in America. There's a large Chinese population. That affects it as well. So you have all these factors that lead to it starting there and being spread there more easily.
Yeah.
And we're also finding that many of the outbreaks in other cities, not all, but a good percentage of them originated from travelers from New York and brought it into various other places in the country.
Right. And I want to say that about Florida. I think DeSantis said something really smart that nobody talks about. What was in Florida? What was in Miami at the beginning of February?
Old
cocaine.
People? I don't know.
The Super Bowl.
Oh yeah, I've already.
So you think
I've
people
well,
come from
New York? Old people, cocaine, Super Bowl, all the same thing.
Yeah, I mean it's all the same thing, and people from around the world. And look where it is. It's mainly staying there. I mean, that's what I tell people. My, as of this recording, if you look at my county, Osceola County, and Orange County, which are the two counties that share Disney World, there have only been under 50 deaths there.
Yeah. Well, if you were the Washington Post, I mean, that would be, they would say the county has been ravaged by coronavirus. So, and the way we calculate these things is interesting. And I think that it would make a good rhetorical study. And we'll get back to the word rhetoric here in a few minutes with another story. But it would make a good rhetorical study because the way a lot of this stuff is counted state by state is as a percentage of new cases in the state and things like that. So we'll see alerts that say like, so I got an alert the other day for a town near where I grew up. I grew up in a very rural area of Illinois. My hometown, 250 people. So a town next to mine is, let's say it's 1,000 people or whatever. I got pinged as Onarga, Illinois, listed as new hotspot for coronavirus. And I thought, well, that's interesting and also weird. I'm curious what this new hotspot is. They have, are you ready for this? In terms of total number of cases reported, 7. 7, Justin, William, 7 cases. But because of the
that
algorithm,
could be just a family.
Because of the algorithm, that is like a big percentage of the new cases reported in the state that week or whatever, so it gets listed as a hotspot. 7 new
cases. Shouldn't it be the opposite of that? This is why your rhetoric point is really well taken. Shouldn't it be, hey, we've done such a good job fighting this that even this small town is showing up on our problem areas list?
Yeah, we've done such a good job tracking this and isolating people that we've discovered 7 cases in middle of nowhere, Illinois. 7.
Yeah. Framing matters.
Absolutely. And it's incredible framing. So best of luck to all these hospitals still under construction. It's interesting. Apparently, some of them won't be permanently closed down, though some of them will. They could be shuttered temporarily in case an outbreak happens or whatever, but I'm assuming most of these won't ever treat any patients whatsoever. In some non-coronavirus news, if we're ready to move on, there's the other thing going on, which is the presidential race.
Well, I want to ask you before we talk about that really quickly. Do you think, both of you, you can give a quick answer here, the fact that other news stories are starting to emerge shows that the media knows the population is getting sick of the coronavirus and they're ready to move on, so the media has to move on?
To some degree, yes. I mean, I think the media would like, I think people were ready for new news stories 4 weeks ago. And I think the media is a big lag measure. But having gone out today to get lunch, I can tell you things here are almost eerily back to normal, save for the fact that we can't go inside anywhere.
Yeah, they released a lot of restrictions on Friday here in California, and things are people are chafing to get back to their lives.
Well, what could be more back to normal than hashtag me too? So anyone who has been paying attention to the presidential race knows that Joe Biden is facing his own hashtag Me Too moment when accuser Tara Reid said that he sexually assaulted her some time ago. I don't know all the details, but I know that he forced himself upon her, but not rape, but sexual assault. And
basically, he did what Trump said that he could.
Allegedly. And so the question about Joe Biden's accuser is, do you give her as much of a voice as any other person, even though she's running against a Democrat? I'm saying that glibly, but that's kind of how it is. And how much should we, believe all women when it's a guy who's facing off against Donald Trump? And one author, Linda Hirschman, author most recently of Reckoning, The Epic Battle Against Sexual Abuse and Harassment, wrote a New York Times piece that could have been headlined, hashtag believe all women, then ignore them. But it was instead titled, I Believe Tara Reid, Joe Biden's accuser, I'm voting for Joe Biden anyway. So the article is strange. The article begins with, "Let's be clear, I believe Tara Reid. I believed Anita Hill, too. She was the person who accused Clarence Thomas of putting a pubic hair on a Coke can. Quaint. What's the constant here? Joe Biden, then the bumbling head of the Senate Judiciary Committee during the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings, now the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee. Long before Ms. Reid, before the reports of the rubbing and the sniffing, I interviewed an advisor to Ms. Hill. Going on, she gives her street cred about how much she should be believed in her wokeness, and how much, you know, she has been a champion of women who have been assaulted, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So she says, so what's a girl to do now? Discounting Ms. Reid's accusation and, one after another, denigrating her corroborating witnesses, calling for endless new evidence, avoiding that you hear her, is nonsense. We are now up to 4 corroborating witnesses, including 1 contemporary corroborating witness, unearthed by Rick McHugh, who is a Ronan Farrow producer, and 1 Larry King live tape. So stop playing gotcha with the female supporters of Mr. Biden or the Me Too movement, making them lie to the camera or perhaps to themselves about doubting her to justify their votes. I'll take one for the team, and this is where it turns. I believe Ms. Reid, and I'll vote for Mr. Biden in the fall." So she explains her reasoning if you want to dive into it. It's all there, but I think this paragraph that I'm going to read kind of sums it up. If I can find it, this website is difficult with the breaking up of everything. Basically, she goes into an explanation of utilitarianism, which is interesting to find in a New York Times article, but not all that fascinating. Where's the paragraph, guys? I can't find it at the moment. Oh, here it is. Sorry. "So what is the greatest good or the greatest harm? Mr. Biden and the Democrats he may carry with him into government are likely to do more good for women and the nation than its competition, the worst president in the history of the Republic, Donald Trump. Compared with the good Mr. Biden can do, the cost of dismissing Tara Reid, and worse, weakening the voices of future survivors, is worth it. And don't call me an amoral realist. Utilitarianism is not a moral abdication. It is a moral stance." Oh boy, Justin. So, what do you make of Linda Hirschman's argument here?
I just don't know why people are getting so upset about Joe Biden sexually assaulting the actress from American Pie. I was really confused at first. I was like, why did Tara Reid get involved with Joe Biden? Like, did he like suddenly like her because he like binged all the Sharknado movies while sitting in his retirement home in the nursing home when he had nothing to do? They were like, "Hey, the senile people can't go out after 7 p.m. So here's the Sci-Fi Channel, and it's a Sharknado marathon." And then he's like, "Oh man, I got to get in touch with Tara Reid." I seriously didn't realize it was like a different Tara Reid. But here's my thing about all of this. Okay, there's a lot we could say about all of this, but it's the same story that's been going on since the 90s. Literally, remember in the 90s when Newt Gingrich had a mistress and the left raked him over the coals for it? Because they were like, "Oh my God, blah, 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 blah. You can't do that. Blah, blah, blah. That's immoral. Well, you're a terrible person. We need to get you out." And then what happened when Bill Clinton literally cheated on his wife in the Oval Office? They still supported him. I don't know why people are incredulous over the left doing this. They always do this. And why the right thinks that it's a good tactic to call them out on their hypocrisy. It isn't. This is the same conversation that's been going on since the 90s. Now they're just emboldened to pivot publicly and say, "Oh, we're arguing utilitarianism now." So by having the conversation, you're just letting them sound more rational because they're acting like they can defend it now. All you have to do is say, "Okay, so not only is Joe Biden senile, now he sexually assaults people," and just treat it as a given. That is why rhetorically what Trump does with his nicknames works. Just keep calling Joe Biden Sleepy Joe. Now you can call him Sleepy Creepy Joe and move on. That's it. It'll stick with people or it won't. having this conversation is, it's just the same conversation over and over again. It's been going on since the 90s, literally.
I can imagine Trump doing much worse than Sleepy Creepy Joe at this point. Rapey Uncle Joe. It's going to get ugly, folks. So, William, I want you to evaluate my hypocrisy, or I've called it in rhetorical terms the hypocrisy paradox, which is that in terms of thinking and consistency and ideas, hypocrisy seems to be one of the worst intellectual crimes you can commit, in the sense that consistency is so important in thought that we should try to avoid hypocrisy at all costs, because, you know, being consistent is radically important to discovering truth. But here's the thing. As Justin said, pointing out people's hypocrisy and using it as a rhetorical tactic seems to be totally ineffective. Yeah. Totally.
It causes people to dig in, right? Like, we see this from, you know, folks that get roped into cults, right? The more inconsistencies and stuff you point out, the harder they dig in, the more rationalizations they come up with. I think part of that is just to do with the way we think. And I don't mean it in some sort of defeatist, like, you cannot have rational thought. I just mean, like, it's totally natural for us to post hoc come up with a rational reason for things that we decide or choose, right? Like, that's just a thing that human brains do, right? It takes a lot of work to actually be rational, right? And you pointing out the hypocrisy may help sort of bolster your own side, but you're right, it doesn't help people think through it correctly, right? When you have to pull that out of someone's thinking, you have to externalize it and give them a way to reconstruct their sort of conceptual framework, right? And just saying you suck, it's basically the equivalent of saying you suck, right? Because you're not just pointing out that they're wrong with it, that their method that they arrived at it is also wrong. Right.
To build on your point, William, when you say that it's a lot of hard work to be irrational, when you try and point out the hypocrisy, not you, these people who are doing it, of these people who are digging in on this and being hypocrites, it's because these people are not rational people. They're emotional thinkers. And what's happening is we're seeing two extreme emotional positions colliding with each other. The two positions are Me Too culture and the outrage over this supposed existence of rape culture, and Trump derangement syndrome. And they have to pick between the two, so they have to come up with, as you're saying, a post hoc rationalization to pick between the two. And it looks like what they're picking is Trump is evil, Trump derangement syndrome, and they're going with that. And I think it makes sense that they would go for that, because they created him as part of Trump derangement syndrome as the embodiment of rape culture. So yeah. To them, Trump is the worst rapist, or is a worse rapist than Joe Biden. Joe Biden only exists because of someone like Trump. I mean, Trump ticks all those boxes, right? Evil white, evil businessman, evil rapist, all of those things.
Well, and how much of this is rationalized in their head by the fact that, you know, all men are rapists, right? So this isn't, for a true believer feminist, like, the fact that Joe Biden may have, you know, sexually assaulted someone? Well, of course, because all men sexually assault, right? Like, to a true believer, this isn't a disqualifier. If you're going to vote for a man, they've probably raped someone before, right?
That's true. It would just be explicit now where it was implicit before.
Exactly.
They would never be surprised. Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, maybe we'll have one news outlet willing to cover the Joe Biden allegation story without bias. Apparently, WGN, the news station out of Chicago, is launching a national nightly news broadcast on September 1 with the promise that it will be 100% absent of bias. Perry Sook, chairman and CEO of the Dallas-based Nexstar Media Group, which owns cable channel WGN America in Chicago and nearly 200 TV stations across the country, announced the start date for News Nation, and reiterated the mission during a call on Wednesday. He said, quote, "This will be hard news, 100% absent of bias. We," I love this paragraph, "we're so serious about that, we're hiring a panel of rhetoricians to review our broadcast for unconscious bias that may creep into the words we use and the reporting that we do." WGN America has hired 30 of the 130 or 40-ish staffers to employ in Chicago to launch the three-hour nightly newscast. This is in addition to an unnamed main anchor team, which they're in negotiations with. So this will be a new competitor to Fox News and MSNBC and CNN, and be a national news broadcast, finally, Justin, with absolutely 100% no bias. Are you excited?
No, not at all. I was excited when you said unnamed anchor, because I thought that's how they were going to prove they had no bias. They weren't even going to name the anchor, because the second you have an anchor with a name and a face, a gender, a race, a name, a build, all of these things create implicit bias, or as they just said, unconscious bias.
Sorry, I just thought of welcome to Veil of Ignorance. I'm your host, unnamed anchor. Sorry.
I mean, that's more towards what they're going to have to do, because if you have rhetoricians on there, they're going to point out the rhetoric of everything. I mean, if you have an I at the end of your name versus a Y, you're Polish or you're Russian, and that creates different biases implicitly.
Yeah. Well, let's make this really explicit, right? Like, I don't want unbiased news. I want objective news. In other words, I want people who state and are open about their bias, right? And try to achieve objectivity in their reporting. The example I know, I've given it 1,000 times, but the example is fighting a virus, right? The virologists are definitely anti the virus, right? They're biased against the virus, right? They want to kill it. They want to eradicate it. But yet, in order to, you know, do their job, they have to remain objective, right? And that's what I want in my reporting. I don't care. That's why I can watch Fox News and struggle to watch MSNBC. Because while Fox News is wildly biased, there are some objective anchors and reporting done there. Whereas with MSNBC, it's so hard to find any objective facts in almost any of their reporting.
Well, right, and that goes to what I was building towards, is the really key term is their term unconscious bias. Now, we had previously seen this, and I had brought this up before when Hillary Clinton said it in a debate and said implicit bias. It looks like they're moving towards the term unconscious bias. And this is a cognate to what we saw with the coronavirus, the idea that you aren't in control of what you do. There are, as we see in economics, externalities. Externalities are unpredicted and uncontrollable effects of your actions. They're trying to apply that to all of us, to all our actions, and to make it a moral case. And this is a perfect example of how they're doing that. Unconscious bias. Well, you can never escape unconscious bias as they define it. It's the idea that everything you're doing is biased based upon that. Now, we believe, and I'm saying we, and you guys can say if you disagree, but I think this is consistent with what William just said, Daniel, we believe that you can be aware of your bias and keep that in check. Check your premises, Belichick your premises, as you're thinking about things and talking about things, that you can explicitly say that to remind yourself and remind other people what the issues are and what the patterns of thought here that are at stake and at play.
Yeah, and I would even modify that slightly, Justin, because it's not just that you need to check them, as in examine them, but I don't want us to imply that somehow bias is bad. Bias is not bad. Bias is, that's sort of like looking at values and saying having values is bad. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like it's a twisted anti-concept that can cause you to you know, go back to basically think that you need the veil of ignorance that Daniel was just talking about, right? You have to. It's why I struggle with a lot of the sort of like diversity movements, right? Like, to me, like...
Right, a lack of bias is
platonic. Well, it's worse than platonic. It's death, right? The only thing that has no bias is not a lie.
Well, I would say Platonism is death, but that's a different discussion. But, no, I agree with you completely. It's, for instance, let's just use an example of regional bias, right? I grew up in Massachusetts, and no matter how hard I try, I can't get that out of me, right? I lived in California.
And
I
man,
in Florida,
others have like, tried, but
jeez,
some of us even want it. Some of us even want it.
Right, and people have tried. But part of that bias is what enabled me to see what was wrong with California so much. So it's also taking, as you're saying, the good things and the bad things from your bias and saying, oh, well, that's a bad thing. I can get rid of that. Here's a good thing. I can keep that. Because different biases have survived over time. They've created value and they've created a good life. So there is value to those biases because they have made a good life and a successful life for them and their progeny and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah. When I see bias, I replace it with values, right? And those could, some of them can be irrational, some of them can be rational. And some of them are sort of irrational, right? Like it depends on what you do with them. And so whenever I...
Well, that's interesting.
Whenever I see bias, I replace
that's
it with
interesting.
Values. And then, and that, you know, that gets back to what diversity should actually mean, right? I want people with many different
right.
kinds of biases, right?
Right.
In other words, I want people with many different kinds of values, not everyone who values the exact same thing.
So I'm going to throw a question to Daniel based upon what you just said as a way of sort of essentializing this. Are we saying that bias based upon rationally held values is good, bias based upon emotions is bad, and that's what's wrong with our society right now? It's not unconscious bias, it's that everyone's bias is based on emotionalism.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack in your statement, but I think I generally agree with the sentiment, and especially in the context of news. What we'll say about bias is that you should be biased towards the facts, for instance. You should be biased towards what happened. You should be biased towards presenting enough information that people can make their own decision, and you should be biased against misleading headlines. You should be biased against people putting their own personal opinions into things that are unnecessary for reporting the news. You should have many biases for and against certain things in the context of journalism. And it's the correct biases that make you objective and incorrect ones that make you unobjective. And emotionalism has a lot to do with that. But, you know, you can have a journalistic story that presents what the emotions are that people are going through, or, like if you're reporting on coronavirus deaths. It could be frustration with the lockdowns. It could be sadness over the loss of loved ones. It could be any number of things. It doesn't have to be emotionless, but you have to understand that what you're picking and choosing is objective or unobjective based on whether you're reporting on what is happening or what you want to be happening.
Yeah, Daniel, I think that's a great point. We don't want to fall into the rationalist trap, right? Like, it's okay that you can not allow, because that's the wrong word. Emotions do bias you. Right? But that's part of being alive, right? Those emotions are, you shouldn't use them to think, right? But you certainly should use them to create, to help generate your values, right? Like what you care about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
Yeah, I certainly wasn't arguing against emotions as having value. I was talking about as the result of your, or sorry, as the basis
yeah,
of your
exactly.
thinking. That's what I was trying to say.
As a means of understanding the world, basically, as an epistemological tool.
Right. The example I would give is, for anyone who listens to the show over and over again, you know this is going one of two ways. It's going in the Snyder direction.
Man, I was hoping for
I would
Brady.
Say...
Brady is dead to us.
Yeah, no, I was going to say. A little bit of a fight with Brady right now. I think there are very much the people who defend Zack Snyder because emotionally they have this association that DC good, Snyder did something they liked, therefore they have this bias towards Snyder where they don't understand what they're defending or what's at stake. Whereas someone like me, I have such an emotional reaction towards Snyder's films because of the way I understand them and because as a way I see it supporting my values. So I understand what I'm talking about. And it can be frustrating to deal with that other side of things because you see that as really, it comes across more as an unconscious bias for them because they can't really express anything beyond just, in this case, anger. And that's where a lot of that comes from, I think, in our society. And I think a lot of this contributes to the two different sides and this, the divide between the two different sides.
Yeah. And in the journalistic context, Justin, it might play out something like this. Unobjective news agency says, we want to make people mad about this. What can we choose about this story to make people mad? Whereas an objective news agency might say something like, hey, what do people think about this story? Oh, they're mad. Okay, well, let's show that they're mad about this thing.
Right, and we actually are seeing that right now.
All the difference in the world in journalism.
Right, and there's a story, and I'm not going to say what it is. You guys can all piece this together. But there's a story circulating right now that is doing that very much and is stoking the fires of people's anger by saying, what can we report about this to make people mad on both sides, rather than asking why people are mad on both sides. And the why people are mad on both sides is, well, we value life. And when certain things happen to life, that's bad. So rather than focus on that, they're focusing on other things that will make people more mad.
Yeah.
I think that's a great way to end this segment.
I do want to note, make sure I pay my foreshadowing off from earlier, that I eagerly await my call to be on the panel of rhetoricians that will check this news agency's unconscious bias.
Nice.
As the self-proclaimed top 50 rhetorician in the United States, I'll be getting a call anytime now, I think.
Sorry, we only want the rhetoricians who support a certain bias.
Damn it.
All right, so well point taken, Daniel. I hope you do get the call, because that would be amazing. But if there's anything I've learned in my cynicism, it doesn't matter if you're the original Zack Snyder fan. People still don't care what you think about Zack Snyder. So why don't we just move on to seeing what I think about other things in a return of the hopeful romantic with JML. To syndication, broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. I need a rerun to better cast the next series of events in the air timeline lapse. My made for TV type was written off in the last season when I wasn't focused on. Man, the new normal is a lot like the old normal. I haven't heard that music in forever. It's great to return to form here, and if you like the return to form, you can always support us on Patreon. Give as much or as little as you want. Patreon.com/themidside, themidside.com/Patreon. So during lockdown, I've been binging a bunch of stuff. During quarantine, whatever term you want to use, I've been binging a lot of stuff, and I finally found the time, or at least the motivation. I shouldn't say the time. I found the motivation to watch The Expanse, the sci-fi show William has been raving about, and I wanted to have a brief conversation about it.
You sure this isn't personal?
You're damn right it's personal.
Oh, apparently we're going to have a show about The Expanse here, because that's our little intro for it. So look for the spinoff podcast about The Expanse. I'm kidding. Don't look for that. But obviously, William really, really loves The Expanse. As you can tell, he took the time to make that cool little intro there. And I have to say that I think that that love is warranted through the first three seasons. So this show is based on a book series that's supposed to be 9 books long. It's the 9th book is not written yet. They're still waiting for it to be finished. Stop me if this sounds familiar with another television show. Each season is based on one of the novels. The first three seasons were on sci-fi. Then it got canceled and picked up and put on Amazon. What I really like about this show is it takes so many elements of shows that were successful, especially in the sci-fi genre, and improves upon them. You see elements of Star Trek. You see elements of Battlestar Galactica. The fourth season is very much like SG-1. It's like one really long episode, well done, of SG-1. There's even very much like Game of Thrones in this, except better. Whereas Game of Thrones is focused on, you know, what's wrong with people, this is focused on people pursuing the value of life. What's the best way for all of these people to live? The show is based in, I would say, the quasi-near future, where Earth is trying to colonize Mars and terraform it so it's like Earth. And then there's also a group of people who live, and they call it the Belt, who work on all the spaceships and everything and the space stations that people live in, either permanently or to get in between Mars and Earth. So basically three factions have emerged: Earth, Mars, and the Belters. The Belters would be the quote-unquote lower class, where they act as if they're the lower class. They feel like they're the most oppressed. Earth would be the most quote-unquote privileged, where they have one – Earth is just one nation controlled by the UN. And then Mars is sort of the more traditional – I saw them linked more like the South, because they're all like, it's very important for us to live with our families and work hard and create a life together and create the world we want. So those are kind of those embodiments. And what changes this world is this thing comes called the protomolecule, and it can infect people, and it does all these weird things that they don't know how it operates. And you have different factions from Earth, different factions from Mars, and different factions within the Belters all trying to deal with the fallout of this protomolecule as they all learn about it. And what's really compelling to me about this show is, narratively, it takes a mid-side approach. And what I mean by that is, there is a space or a spaceship that has on it two people from Earth, a Belter, and a Martian. And they say Martian, but they're just humans. They just live on Mars. And it has those four people. And those four people are trying to do what's right among all of the other politics going on in the world. And that ship is sort of like the mid-side ship in this universe. And through the first three seasons, it escalates, where you start out, you're trying to figure out what's going on with this infection, oh, the protomolecule, and I'm not going to spoil it, but each season builds on that. And in season two and three especially, they do an interesting thing where halfway through it feels like a season finale, everything changes, and then the back half of the season, new things happen, and then everything changes, and it does that. Up until the fourth season, where the fourth season, it just became, we're going to go to a planet and deal with the problems of this civilization, and it doesn't seem to progress the main plot of the overall series.
Ait?
William, did we lose you? I was expecting you to jump in there.
So, I think season four is probably the slowest season. But
that's certainly true.
I think there's a purpose behind that slowness, because you had said that it's based on the books, but it's also based on some of the supporting novellas. So, for example, that story that takes a place on Mars in season four is a self-contained novella in the universe. It's not in the main series. And
see, that makes more sense, because that stupid plot line, like, they've done similar one episode arcs.
Yeah.
And then they folded it back in, right? When I think about the guy who discovered, I'll call it warp speed, but the guy who discovered that, or the racer
that
guy.
That was a novella.
Right,
the
those
racer
were great.
Is a novella. Yep.
Okay. Well, and that was a great one-episode arc, because the character was really well-defined, and they folded it into the overall story well. It's the same thing with that story. I really like that character. It's a great character.
Bobby.
I like that actress. Yeah. I think she's, Bobby. I think she's beautiful.
Based on I'm trying to describe this in a spoiler-free way, Bobby pays off next season. But if you had a whole season with no Bobby, this is a struggle with adaptation, right? Like, how do you do a whole season with no Bobby, right? If Bobby's going to be important later in the story, does that make sense?
Well, right. It's a struggle with pacing, and it's a struggle also with contracts.
Yeah.
Because this was something I actually wondered with Thomas Jane. If you have someone who makes infrequent appearances, how do you guarantee they're going to be able to do those appearances and you don't end up with a Henry Cavill mustache situation?
Yeah. Well, and I think
for the uninitiated, what I'm referring to is when Henry Cavill did reshoots for Justice League, he had grown a mustache for Mission Impossible Fallout. And they didn't let him cut it because they needed him to film Mission Impossible Fallout. So you have the horrendous CGI. Now imagine in the Final Justice League. Now imagine you had a character that you had in the script and you needed for the books, but you couldn't guarantee them a full season pay. And then you need to write them out because they're not available.
Yeah. I think also there's a lot. I know that season four is not, it sort of mostly universally said to be the weakest season. I think that I can see maybe some decrease in or different choices being made on where to put the production value on season four. Cause
that's true as well. I agree. I noticed
so,
that.
But I also see way more subtle visual storytelling in season four. So in some ways the show is maturing, right? So I'm hopeful that if the audience stays significant enough, and I don't know if you guys know the story of how this got taken to Amazon. Basically, it was a personal appeal by a bunch of fans led by the actor who the Martian on the ship, basically went and talked to Jeff Bezos like at a conference or something and said, you need to buy this show. And he made a phone call and did it.
I have read that the actors are very passionate about doing all nine novels, all nine seasons, which you don't really see. And I think that speaks to, you know, this is why Lost was so successful. I think this is why Snyder's films are successful. That speaks to the importance of having actors believe in the material rather than just pragmatically being like, oh, this is a role I need to get paid in, or this is the next step in my career. The fact that they're doing material they actually believe in and really enjoy, I think really comes through in their performances.
And I don't want us to talk just about season four, because I don't want people to think that, oh, it's just three seasons and then it's shit, because that's not it at all. I think season four...
It's not... Look, season four... Let me be clear. Season four is not shit. It's just a really long episode of SG-1. Exactly. And what I mean by that is SG-1, they go to a planet, there's a problem, they solve it in one episode and move on. There was even that Mandalorian episode, Daniel, where they go to the planet and solve the problem. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely.
It was like three or four. That was very... Have you ever seen SG-1, Daniel?
I've never seen SG-1.
Okay, well, when I watched that episode, I was like, oh, this is the SG-1 episode of The Mandalorian, where, like, the woman falls in love with him and stuff, and then it just drops after one episode. So that's very much what the arc is. And it's not, it's tremendous. It is a tremendous arc for what it is. But the issue I have is, one of the things I loved about the integration of this story over seasons 1 through 3 is the way the smaller plot... Such as season 3, I thought they did a tremendous thing with the introduction of the character of Prax and using him to say, we're going to now focus on getting your daughter back. And the way they integrated getting Prax's daughter back with the overall arc of the entire series was tremendous. And there was payoff to that. Whereas in season 4, there isn't as much payoff with that. It was just, okay, that we took care of the problem.
No,
on the
I
planet.
Haven't read the books, and people who have read the books first have a very negative opinion of the show. Okay? Because there's a lot that got cut. All right? Now, moving to Amazon.
The book will always be better than the show or movie, people. Yeah. It will always be better because you can show the thoughts of the characters and also explicitly call out the ideas. Because one's a visual medium, which is harder to communicate in, and one's a textual medium, which is easier to communicate in.
So I want to kind of turn the corner on the season 4 talk, but I got to get 2 points out. The first one is there were less shows. Amazon ordered less shows for a season than what Sci-Fi ordered for a season. So there's less show count. So
that's true. Only 10 episodes.
You have to cut a lot, right? You have to be very choosy, right? You have to cut to the bone. The other thing is, with that in mind, the motivation is when we last saw, and I don't think these are maybe minor spoilers. When we last saw Mars, Mars was seemingly unified and unstoppable in their goal, right? If they had just turned on a dime, that would be very jarring. But I think that whole storyline is all visually told that Mars is disintegrating, right? Like that's going to be a major plot point, I believe. Like I don't know where the books go, but I believe that's going to be a major plot point. I think that is a setup that gets paid off. And so I bet once we see season 5, we're going to retroactively look back and say, oh, this integrates with that. Does that make sense? Because I can't imagine them stopping the integration. Like this is the whole point of the show, how integrated it is.
Right. I I got what they were going for, but again, I thought they could accomplish it in fewer episodes. Daniel, you had something you wanted to say?
I was going to talk about the nature of books, so.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I've only watched like 3 episodes, I think, and they were very good. I just can't find the time to get into shows now. Because then I come back to it, you know, 4 weeks later, and I'm like, what the hell happened? Anyway, my point about books is not only do you do get that introspection, you get the exposition, more of it, but books are very enthymematic, to use the Aristotelian term about argument, which is you put in everything. You put in any suppressed premise in your head with words, i.e. what someone looks like, how they move, what their emotions are like, what the scene looks like, how dark and light it is, etc. You put in all of that when you're reading, but in visual medium, they tell you what it is explicitly because they're showing you. And so you don't get to do that. And if you already have preconceived notions about something, then and something doesn't match your preconceived notions, you can feel a sense of loss.
Yeah, and the inverse of that is if you understand what quote-unquote argument the author is trying to make, you will fill in however you say that word, Daniel.
Enthymematically.
There you go. I know the word, I just can't pronounce it. You will fill it in that way with what makes sense in your own experience, in your own bias. Which is why novels can cross cultures and cross people, because different people will fill in the blanks that way, even though it's the same sort of argument. Whereas in a visual story, that is, as you're saying, Daniel, automatically filled in. So when you look at Amos or you look at Jim Holden, and you look at Naomi, and Naomi Nagata is an interesting one for me.
Oh,
let's just
man.
Talk about that
one. Season four, well, yeah. The
because
season
her last name,
her standing somewhere, trying not to spoil things, for the first time, right? Amazing, right? Like a big emotional hit,
yeah.
Right? Like you've been drawing this character and building her up, and she gets this payoff, you know?
Right.
And Miller's Viking send off. You know, like, this is so good, right? Like, they're handling these character moments, Whedon-esque, right? These are Whedon-esque character moments that are very well paid off.
I don't know if you can say that around here anymore. We might have just lost, like, 5 Snyder Cut subscribers, but...
Hey, I am a big critic of Whedon, but he does characters so well, right?
Yeah, he has a strength. His heyday's back in the day, right? Late 90s, early 2000s. But... what I was going to say about Naomi is her last name is Nagata. So people might have pictured her looking differently and acting differently because they would have thought of more of a, maybe a Blasian approach than just a black woman. So you see her, and her name's Naomi Nagata. If you had pictured something different, as Daniel's saying, you might have seen her differently. Likewise, she's a belter, and she's a very strong character, but she doesn't speak like the other belters. And she's not built like you would think the stereotype of a strong woman would be. And I don't mean the South Park character of strong woman. I mean, she's not like a professional wrestler, right? She's not built like Charlotte Flair or something like that. So people might have pictured her different in her head. But for me, the character works because I think the actress pulls it off.
Yeah. So I know we're all stuck on the season 4. So let's go back to the beginning. So... when you watch, and I encourage, I'm so biased to go back to our news segment to get people to watch this show because I want this show to keep going. So why should you watch this show? I think what will hook you in the first season is it's taking, like Justin said, the elements of a good detective novel, of good hard sci-fi. There's some soft sci-fi in there too, but there's hard sci-fi there. They take how the Earth Martian belt technologies work really seriously. There's time delay and communications that are plot points, right? There's how they move and how the consequences of propulsion. Yes, there is a Epstein drive.
I specifically liked that people who grew up on Mars had a hard time and had to take drugs if they go to travel to Earth and spend any time on Earth.
And all these things, and they're not just like superlative, right? They're integral to the plot. And the characters feel like they grew. Like I said, the Belters, the way that culture works feels like it's taken a lot from history. Like think like the IRA or the Palestinian, you know, authority and things like that, right? Like it feels a lot like that, right? Like they've taken the consequences of what humans are and how they would organize and feel. Other things I like about it. This is diversity in the good way, right? And what I mean by that is there's definitely classes here and there's conflicts between those classes, right? But each faction has their good guys and bad guys, and we explore those things, right? And people sometimes make the wrong choice and the consequences happen, right? Naomi makes a few bad choices and has to learn from those. Holden does. Miller does, right? All these things have consequences, and you feel even when you see them making a different choice or a wrong choice, that it's a motivated choice, right? I don't think you see anyone making a choice that you don't understand.
Yeah, I agree with all that. That's what I was trying to capture by saying that the ship is very much the Midside. Yeah. I think that's done very intentionally. I think the way that the crew of that ship is made up is designed very intentionally, both as embodying the Mars, Earthers, Belters conflicts, as well as the different personalities demonstrate the conflicts that we as human beings have, both external, so with each other, and internal to ourselves.
To pay the show a high compliment, when I was watching the early episodes, it felt like the two head writers were Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, and Robert Heinlein, who wrote The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And the mashup of those two, even though they couldn't be more different writers, felt really right when I was watching it. So,
yeah. And to build on that, I think that's very well taken, Daniel, that description. To build on it and kind of put a bow on this here so we can head out of this episode, I think the character of Jim Holden is a great sort of continuation of the Captain Kirk character, but for the current generation. I think he's exactly what Captain Kirk would be in the current millennial generation. And it struck me that his name is probably very intentional. And what I mean by that is I really think the James comes from James Kirk, and I think the Holden really comes from Holden Caulfield. And I think that's why they named him what he did. Because if you look at James Holden and you look at his arc and where he starts, I think you really see him going from more of a Holden Caulfield type character to a James T. Kirk type character, but not sort of the emotional recklessness of James T. Kirk, more of a rational for today's age. So I think all of that's intentional.
So Justin, why should you watch this?
All right. Well, we already said it a bunch. Okay. I mean, it's the best sci-fi that's out there right now.
Moving on.
I mean, I can't name a Daniel or William. Name a sci-fi show that comes close to it. Name a decent sci-fi show these days.
It's a dead genre. I think I said it during our pre-show meeting. Sci-fi is a dead genre right now. We have STD. We have the abomination that is Picard. We have Star Wars on its last legs with Mandalorian, and then they announced that creepy radical feminist going to make more Star Wars. Like it's a dead genre, right?
The HBO show, what's that called?
Westworld.
Oh, Avenue 5.
Westworld.
I don't watch Westworld, but Avenue 5 ended up being mediocre but enjoyable.
Yeah, but it's sci-fi.
Yeah.
It definitely, I would say that if you like Deep Space Nine more than you like Voyager or TNG, you'll really enjoy this show. It really carries on the tradition of a Deep Space Nine or Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, and I would say it's not as gritty or dark. Its view of humanity is not as malevolent as those shows. So it's even better. I would say.
Better than DS9? Okay, that's a whole other podcast.
I didn't say better than DS9. Discussion. Better than Battlestar Galactica. Okay.
Well, anything's better than that shit ending for Battlestar Galactica. Anyway, that's another podcast. But if you're used to the MCU view of the world, you're not going to like... You're going to think this is way too dark and gritty. But, all right. Let's put a bow on this episode. What did we learn this trip, William?
I learned that my bias in favor of The Expanse would not let me broadcast news at this new WGN America.
Daniel?
I learned that although I am a self-proclaimed top 50 rhetorician in the United States, that I will likely not be getting a call from WGN to serve on their panel of rhetoricians, although please call me, I'm open. Justin?
I learned that apparently my malaise with current television and entertainment is due to the lack of science fiction, and I hadn't explicitly realized that before.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, we hope you learned something this week here on The Midside. Thanks for joining us. Go to themidside.com/podcast and listen to past episodes during your Great Suppression lockdown. Also, go to Apple Podcasts and Google Podcasts. Subscribe. Get this delivered the moment Justin presses publish on Midside Monday, and when he's super excited on Midside Sunday.
I had to get last week's out there. I couldn't sit on it. It was so good. And we got some, I got some positive comments. No one explicitly mentioned the rant, but people said some really good things about the episode.
Yeah, so go back and listen to last week if you missed it. Quite a good episode all around. Leave us 5 stars on Apple and Google if you would, please. Help us move up the rankings there. Even if you hate the show, 5 stars, tell us you hate it. Thanks to Liberty.me for syndicating us to our libertarian audience friends. Appreciate ya. And Patreon.com/TheMidside. Give a couple bucks. Keep the lights on. Until next time, tell a friend about the show. We really appreciate your friends tuning in because that helps us grow our Midsiders. Until next time, we love you.
This concludes your journey into The Midside. I'm Justin M. Lesneski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a stay, Betaloda. You know, watching The Expanse, I kept turning on the closed captioning because I really wanted to know what they were saying in the Belter language, but they never really translate it for you.
Oh, I just always figured it out from the emotional approach what they were saying.
Exactly. Isn't that great? You don't even know what they're saying, but it's self-consistent and you kind of know what they're saying.